Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Sacred Podcast. We are on hiatus at the moment, so we wanted to stay in touch with a few extra bits and bobs. And this is a recording of a podcast that I guested on with Clementine Morrigan. Regular listeners might remember that I interviewed Clementine for The Sacred a little while ago, and I was really delighted that she invited me to come on her podcast after reading my book, Fully Alive. Clementine is a writer, a moral philosopher, an essayist. She calls herself a punk. She's a woman of the left. She writes about incest. That doesn't come up. She is a vegan. She's queer. She's polyamorous. And she really enjoyed reading my book that is mainly about Christianity, which was pure joy for me because I'm so interested in these conversations across tribes, in seeking to understand where each other are coming from our wildly different perspectives. I really hope you enjoy listening. We had a very juicy conversation. It went places that other conversations haven't gone, which I was really glad happened. I wanted to note that Clementine is herself quite sweary, and I found myself becoming more sweary in her company because I think I mirror people who I'm with. So apologies for that. I'm sure you will cope. Your ears are not too delicate for the odd F-bomb. But yeah, not my usual. It was interesting to me that came out. I hope you enjoy it. Let me know what you think.
Welcome, Elizabeth.
It's really great to be here.
And do you want to just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, your background, and the work that you do?
I can try. It always gives me a sort of existential crisis because I don't know how to describe myself.
That's perfect, though. That's perfect.
Yeah, good. There's space for that. So right now, the main things that I do are I'm a writer and a podcaster. I have a podcast called The Sacred. And I also do some work with charities and individuals in the sort of nonviolent reconciliation peace building space. And before that, I ran a think tank, a religion think tank. And before that, I worked at the BBC making radio programs for Radio 4. So I'm a real sort of audio loving person. But beyond that sort of CV stuff, which I always feel is, you know, such a small signifier, I live in community, very small micro monastery with my family and another family. And I'm really interested in these. I'm just like obsessed with the deep stuff. Why are we here? How should we live? What is a human? What do we owe each other? All that kind of stuff.
Beautiful. And yeah, I was on The Sacred, just in case listeners are interested. I was actually on Elizabeth's podcast a while back. I don't know when that was.
Like 6 months, maybe.
Yeah. And so you guys can check out that episode as well if you're interested. And so important to this book and important to your life is the fact that you're a Christian. And do you want to just say a little bit about that? I know that's a very broad question to ask, but for people who are sort of just not – like, how do you frame your Christianity in relationship to the work that you do, I guess would be the question.
Yeah. I mean, whenever that – I have sort of come to peace with the term, but I always want to, like, heavily caveat it with awareness of the associations that people will have. Mm-hmm. You know, that people have some good reasons for being hostile or skeptical about Christianity. My brothers and sisters – and myself, I've not always been the best at, I think, telling what I see as the heart of the thing, which is defined by love, right? Defined by justice. But I also feel this complex relationship to it because I wasn't really brought up in it. I was a kind of 80s kid in the UK, which religion is so weird in the UK compared to the United States. I'm trying to feel my way as to kind of what the Canadian context is, but we have quite a lot of public religion, you know, with the king and the parliament,
right?
Still quite a lot of religious involvement in schools, but it's this very dilute Anglican in general in public. Mm-hmm. It's this very sort of ceremonial but not at all bombastic or oppressive, really, form of public religion. It's always felt like it's quite spacious. And that was in the background for me growing up, but it wasn't really a thing. And then I had this very powerful ecstatic conversion experience, like flat on the floor encounter with divine love. And then I became an atheist because it didn't make any sense intellectually. And then I've sort of found my way back to feeling like there's such depth and beauty and wisdom in his tradition, but also with a real sense of knowing what it sounds like from the outside and a lot of kind of empathy and solidarity, really, for those who would not call themselves that.
Yeah, the Canadian context is interesting because I live in Quebec, and Quebec and Canada are almost like two different countries, you know? Mm-hmm. And Quebec is like French Canada. And then and I'm not from Quebec. I'm like literally an immigrant, even though I'm in technically the same country. It's kind of like immigrating to a different country. And so in Quebec, it's Catholic, right? Mm-hmm. And Catholicism and the French identity are like really tied together. So keeping the Catholicism is very tied to like French, like to Quebecois identity. And then the rest of Canada is like a little bit different, but just for your curiosity.
Yeah.
But yeah, I totally get what you're talking about. Maybe I talked about this when I was interviewed on your podcast, but like when I dropped out of high school and moved to Toronto to be in a queer alternative school for kids who had been driven out of the mainstream school system due to homophobia, like the school was in the basement of a church. Like the church that it was like, I don't know, I'm so bad at Christianity, but it was United Church, I feel. And
I'm not going to test you.
thank you. But yeah, it was a church and they like had this space for queers. So I have, even though like I grew up in a small town that was very homophobic and very Christian, and that definitely I experienced homophobia through like people justified their homophobia through Christianity, I have also had the experience of being in a very like welcoming space. So I know that it all exists. And I'm really like curious about your work, and I'm really like, I just love the way that you're so invested in communicating across difference. Right. And I want to just tell listeners that when you dive into this book, which I hope you do, Fully Alive, that like for me as a person who I think couldn't be more different than Elizabeth on so many levels, right? Like I'm queer, polyamorous, like vaguely like witchy, spiritual, and like and like, you know, I've never been to church. And yet I found so much resonance in our ideas. In fact, I think you and I have so much in common in terms of like our ethics and our worldview, but we just ground them in different places. And I really found that your book was super, did a great job of being like respectful of difference. So I just want to tell readers that. Yeah, and you as well, of course.
Thank you. And I'm so glad you found that because, yeah, having watched your work from a distance, I was like, wow. You're right, like totally different formation, different journey, some different conclusion on some things, but the heart of like human, inalienable human dignity.
And exactly.
It is possible to be in relationships of respect and curiosity and empathy with people with radically different opinions from us. And actually that's more humanizing than this defensive and defended withdrawal into our little boxes. I was like, oh, it's like fresh air.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that comes through really strongly in your book. And I think, you know, you in your think tank and on your podcast, like you've had a lot of experience interviewing people who are quite different from yourself. And I wanted to ask you about your approach with that because it's very interesting, specifically like how you interview people who are different from yourself. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So it's really grounded in my understanding of the nonviolent tradition and but I came to it through a really weird way. You know, I had a sense of like part of the sort of treasures of my inheritance, the heritage of my particular wisdom path is the things that Jesus said about loving our enemies and kind of resisting tribalism and mm-hmm. and being people that can, you know, he was like the sort of personification of an anti-polarizing person. Mm. He's just like crossing tribes everywhere he goes. He doesn't care who he's seen with. He has no like, gives no thought to his reputation. He's always going to the most outsider person in the place. I sort of knew all that in theory, but it was actually raising toddlers and seeing the way that fight or flight makes us, my friend Rich Bartlett talks about actually it's almost being like demon possession, right? We lose our minds when we are anxious, triggered, threatened. All those hormones shut down empathy. They shut down curiosity. They make it really hard to stay in conversation. And so it was a combination of the nonviolent tradition, which I get through the New Testament, and then actually this understanding of what's going on hormonally and kind of in my neurobiology when I encounter someone who I feel threatened by. And those things really helped me go, I think it's actually possible for me to override my fight or flight response. I think it's possible for me to steady myself, to not listen to the bit of my body that's telling me to fight back or run away, argue or withdraw. Mm-hmm. Like, it's possible to stay in curiosity and openness. And so over time, I've just built the muscle. And it's every time I have a guest who's even vaguely controversial, you know, not just you, like every guest that comes on, someone gets in touch and says, how dare you have those? I've just had Peter Hitchens, who's like hardcore conservative, grumpy brother of Christopher Hitchens in the UK. How dare you have this guy on who believes all these terrible things? Like, you need to put him straight. You need to tell him off. You need to push back. And I'm like, that happens a lot. That's not my calling. My calling is to listen and to try and understand how he gets to where he gets to, because I think that really helps us. And so just steadying myself, calming myself, not actually going into interviews where I don't feel able to listen with curiosity and empathy. There's a few people that I've not invited on because I'm like, I don't think I can calmly be in conversation with you yet. I have more soul work to do.
Yeah. And part of what you do specifically is, like, you ask people about their lives, which I think is a very interesting strategy, because when we are like primed for a fight, like on both sides, right? When a person is feeling like, I'm probably going to have to defend my position, you know, and another person is like, this person's going to say all these fucked up things that are really going to offend me. Like, you know, we aren't actually looking at the whole person. We're looking at their beliefs, like disconnected from the history of their life. And you start with the story. And I think that that is, first of all, just beautiful. Like, as a writer, I love that, to come in through the story, but also it's so humanizing.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it, so I start with the deep values, not because anyone has got a particularly articulate answer usually, but because you're immediately at depth rather than like, this is the particular political thing we disagree on or whatever it is. And then I ask them about their childhood. And I did this for 2 years before I realized what that does. It creates an imaginative space in the person speaking, because to reach for those memories, part of their brain has gone back there. And in the person listening, they are, you imagine them as a child, right?
Exactly.
You imagine Peter Hitchens as a child, or whoever is the person that you're finding hard. It's much harder to hate someone when you remember that they were once 8 years old and scared.
Mm-hmm.
And that just like that affects our neurobiology. It affects our ability to stay in hatred or contempt.
Yes.
And that those when we're in those very triggered tribal moments, the person that we're speaking to and listening to is not fully human. They are some sort of cipher for their position. And so my job and what I'm trying to do is restore our sense of them as fully human. And it's not that many people go, I completely changed my position on this thing listening to this person, but the number of people that say, oh, I actually sort of understand how they got there and they're not a monster. And that feels like a healthy thing to be doing in public.
It's so important. And I think about this all the time, like just from a pragmatic, like political like perspective, in terms of like, if we like, I'm a leftist, I'm like, if we want to win, if we want to win these goals, like we need numbers. Like there's no way for us to win in this fractured way, right? We need like mass solidarity. Like if we want to make movement on climate change, we need everybody showing up, right?
Yeah.
And we can't have so much divisiveness. But you know, this is something I talk about on this podcast all the time, but like even on the left, we are constantly infighting. So how do we even begin to build solidarity with people who are quite different from ourselves, like across the political divide, you know? And I always like joke that I'm like, conservatives, like, I get it. I want to conserve things too. Family values actually sounds great. Like having a nice dinner with people you love sounds important to me. Like the way that people might be framing like what is a threat to family values is something that I would have disagreement with.
Mm-hmm.
But the shared value is there. You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
because I know that, it makes it easier for me to have empathy for those people, understanding for those people, and also like a more of a chance of communicating with them successfully. Because I'm not being like openly rude and hostile from the get-go. So I think you model that really, really well. So your book is, I mean, I think if I had just heard the description of the book without knowing you, I would not have read it. I'm just going to be honest.
Of course.
But basically, the book uses the framework of the seven deadly sins and sort of like unpacks them and looks at them from different angles. And then, you know, shows us not just like what is the sin, but like what is the lesson and like what is the behavior that we want to move towards instead. But then positions it in such a way that it is directed at not necessarily Christian readers, like people who might be Christian curious or just spiritual curious or who are looking for some kind of guideposts in their own ethical spiritual development. And I love that. I would never have thought in my wildest dreams that the seven deadly sins could be generative for me, because I am a bit exposed to it, because even though I was not raised Christian, I spent 12 years in AA. So there's a lot of Christian influence in AA, and there's certain readings in a book called The 12 and 12, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, which is a separate book from the main text. It's like a supplementary text in AA. But there's a part of it that's about the deadly sins. Yeah. And I always hated this part. Like, I never wanted to read this part. I would just roll my eyes and be like, this is so annoying. Like, don't tell me that lust is a sin. And so I really appreciated your book because it really breaks down those words and strips away the sort of like cultural meanings that have attached themselves to those, that list of sins. And you kind of, you give different interpretations of it that I think are way easier, I think, for a lot of people to enter into, and also showed that it was very in alignment, actually, with my worldview. So, but okay, so let's talk about wrath. So wrath, like, do you want to just define wrath, like, briefly for the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, this is nothing in this book. Not nothing, I hope, but what you don't get from this book is, like, this is the formal objective definition handed down through centuries of the church. This is like my working definition. And wrath for me is this is the subset of anger that disconnects us. So my definition of sin in general is first the human propensity to fuck things up, which I think is very helpfully palate cleansing to get rid of all the religious dustiness around it. And then disconnection, right? And so some anger can be righteous, right? That's all over my tradition. Jesus got really fucking angry sometimes. And I don't think anger is a sin. But the bit that tends to contempt, the bit that makes us dehumanize other people and pull back into ourselves, is how I'm defining wrath. It is, there's a big dollop of contempt in there. And Arthur Brooks defines contempt as anger mixed with disgust. And it's the bit where we just cannot bear to be around someone. And it is not anger in the service of relationship. It's anger as power over. And I see this dynamic throwing out all over the place. And listeners of this podcast will not need to be convinced that humans have, left to our own devices and without some help and some support and some invitation, we don't always know how to play well together, right? We find people, I define it as people like me and people not like me, you know, people that remind us of ourselves or who we are. It is essentially people who remind us of ourselves, but people who are in agreement with us, or we have things in common with, we prefer them. We all do. It's like down the centuries, across cultures, it's one of those just like constants in humans. But people not like me, We can have institutions and practices and habits, which means we can actually learn from each other and live together really well. Or that bit of us that prefers people like me can be amplified, and we can just divide into these smaller and smaller tribes and externalize evil into other people and other groups and not pay attention to what's going on in ourselves. So those dynamics of wrath, all of your listeners will be very familiar with in their own lives and in wider culture.
Absolutely. I just wanted to say one thing to go back a little bit to what you said at the beginning about, you know, not speaking, this is not like official theological, whatever. When I once did a research paper on Mary, so I have dabbled. I love the Virgin Mary. She's very important to me. And when I was doing this research paper on her, I came across a distinction in some of my research between like what they were calling like Mariology, or if you're not talking about Mary specifically, you would call like theology, like the official doctrines of the church, versus mm-hmm. what the researcher was calling lived faith. And mm-hmm. I loved the expression lived faith. I think it's beautiful. Yes. And the way that people live their faith is often quite different from the way that like the official doctrine of the time is saying that the faith is, you know, and that's always been the case, like in Christianity and in other types of religions. It's always been the case that if you go into some village, the way people are practicing their religion there is going to be different, and their yeah. own specific relationship to it and the meaning that they're taking out of it. And so I think that that itself is very generative and it doesn't need to be the official story. So I just wanted to say that. Yeah, and then to get back to Wrath, I think the story that stood out to me so much in this part of the book was the story about the woman on the bus. And so basically, like, you got onto a bus with your little kids, and it was an empty bus, and your kids were sitting on the seat, and an older woman came on and, like, pretty rudely was like, "I want to sit where the kid is sitting. Move your kid." And then you, like, met her rudeness back by being flippant and being like, "Well, you could have said please," you know. And so you're caught in this dynamic where you guys are definitely like, you have positioned
hostile.
You're hostile, you're the enemy, and you're just like awkwardly sitting there beside each other on the bus. And then what you did was crazy and just really powerful for me. So do you want to just tell the listeners about how you responded to that situation?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, I can feel it in my body even telling the story. There's nothing like it when you're just like, who is this joker? And you cannot get away from them because you're in this like sweaty and confined situation, just like arguing with her in my head, under my breath. But we had been applying this parenting technique with our highly challenging toddler at the time called the do-over. And it's an American phrase, I think. I wasn't familiar with it before we used it. But basically, when you're in this very intractable complex where everyone is losing their mind and screaming and stressed and easily offended and lashing out, someone just needs to call time. Someone needs to go, okay, time out. And if you can make each other laugh, it's really great. So I would say, time out. And then I'd go out the front door and I'd come in again and say, hello, how nice to see you. And it just breaks the tension somehow and stops the thing escalating and spiraling, because particularly, you know, we are so interdependent and enmeshed with each other that when we are exuding stress hormones, the other person's body reacts by producing more stress hormones, right? We have this vicious cycle of when we're triggered, and anything that we can do to just like stop that. And so I said, shall we start again? My name's Elizabeth. What's your name? And she laughed because we both knew it was being ridiculous. You know, it just breaks the tension. It was like, yeah, that sounds much nicer than sitting here on the bus, just like balls of tension about who this stupid woman is. And we got chatting, and she, as it turns out, she is people like me, right? She lives in my area. When she got back from hospital, we both have a similar chronic pain condition. The power of some of these practices, which are not mine, to de-escalate situations of tension and conflict never fail to amaze me. It's like magic. And it's so much fun now because I'm like, oh, what's going to happen if I just do something unexpected?
It's so brave and it's so vulnerable, you know, because you're showing like your softness to someone. Like, you're both locked in a situation where you're both being hard to each other. You're both being cold. And you suddenly choose to, like, show your vulnerability and be the one who's open, which is risky because, you know, what if they don't respond that way? What if they respond with contempt to your attempt at vulnerability, right? Which is always a possibility. But I think that you're right that the fear of that is so intense that people don't try it. But in reality, it's so unexpected. And people are also so longing for connection and so longing to be seen that I think a lot of people are going to take that that invitation if we're brave enough to be the one to give it. And then I was absolutely delighted by how the story developed that, like, later somebody else on the bus was, like, complaining about the positioning of your stroller. And then this woman was now standing up for you. So that's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful. So I think there's a lot there, you know, for – like a lesson for it's a nice addition to the work that I do in thinking about how do we de-escalate these conflicts that are getting so out of control and return to the human behind that, you know? And like, can we actually just be kind to each other first? Yeah. And then, you know, and this was just a situation on a bus, but if we are in a situation where we're having major political differences or major issues, like starting with the human level first is going to help us to navigate that thorny area, right?
Yeah.
And I think
yeah.
it's a really good, like, contempt in like couples therapy world, you know, people say contempt is the one thing you should never do in your partnership because contempt is the thing that damages relationships, and if is not repaired, like, it will destroy the relationship. Like, you can't continue to feel safe and vulnerable in an experience of being treated with contempt. And so I know that, like, I'm so careful about showing contempt in my close and loving relationships. But I do think we have this tendency with people that who we're just fighting with, like, random people. And this happens to me sometimes. I get like, I'm like, don't reply to it. Why are you replying to this DM? Like, when people are just in my DM starting shit in a totally hostile way, I'm like, I don't actually need to engage with that. And I know if I do engage with it, I'm probably going to engage in a way that's not definitely in alignment with my highest values.
It is so easy. And in the moment, it feels righteous, right? Mm-hmm. It feels pure and moral to respond with like to like. But it's from the Gottman Institute, isn't it? That like contempt is the universal asset in relationships. I think the same holds true of societies. If we allow ourselves to show contempt in public, even if people are being objectively completely inappropriate or racist or homophobic or whatever it is, we are contributing to dynamics that are ultimately dissolving the bonds between us. And it, you know, I can't always do it. I really can't. But the days when I can, like if people come at me in my DM, sometimes all it takes is you seem angry. Like that. And that's another parenting thing. It's like name someone's emotions. You don't even have to agree with it. You just have to acknowledge their emotions and something switches. And they'll be like, yeah. Sorry, yeah, I'm really angry. I'd be like, you know, I understand. Like, it's like three or four messages, and I've had people like apologize because I met them with kindness and curiosity, not like for like. Or even if I can't manage kindness and curiosity, like sometimes I'll just respond, "Ow," and that's enough, right? I have shown that you have hurt me, and then they go, "Oh." Oh crap! Yeah, like it's not for everyone sometimes, but most people, honestly, most people, it snaps them out of it sufficiently for them to realize what they're doing, and the like demon possession / hormonal overload lifts.
I think it's a very interesting strategy. So I want to move on to another sin because I want to get through a couple of them in this interview. So. The one I want to go to next is, I think, really juicy and interesting, which is lust. So you knew I was going to talk about it.
And everyone else has completely dodged it. So I'm delighted.
Okay, great. I'm so glad. I was like, immediately, I'm interested. I was actually, very, very into this chapter. I feel very aligned. And it's interesting because, like I was saying, we're so different, right? Like, you know, you talk about in the book, like literally, you know, not having sex until you were 28, not having sex until you were married, which is, I think, kind of an unusual thing now these days. I think it's pretty unusual these days. You know, and then for me, like I've had tons of sexual partners. I went through my like trauma compulsive sexuality phase and then, you know, got healthy and then chose to be polyamorous. And now I'm polyamorous and, you know, have no interest in marriage, et cetera. So on paper, you know, you would think, actually, I think that there would be contempt from both sides in a lot of situations where two people like us would meet. Because I definitely know that, like, obviously Christians can sometimes have contempt or can be very judgmental.
Super judging,
of people who are like, you know, non-monogamous or sexually adventurous in certain ways. And then on the other side, I also think that, you know, my side can be very judgmental of people, not even just Christians, but just of people who aren't that sexual or who choose to be monogamous or whatever, are more reserved or conservative or private in their expression of sexuality. And so, you know, it's not helpful on either side, right? And it's like, I'm always trying to say, like, in my education, I do a lot of education work on polyamory. Like, I'm always just like, I don't even want to spend a lot of time talking about this because it doesn't seem necessary, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I'm not positioning polyamory as superior. I'm not positioning myself as more evolved. I am talking about a relationship style that works for me, mm-hmm. and why it works for me, and sharing information for those who are interested in that. But it doesn't have to be a competition. And like, actually what we all want, I think, is to find relationships and sexuality that is deeply affirming, fulfilling, and where we feel human and where we feel seen, you know? And so, yeah. And then, but I love your critique of hookup culture. And I think this is something that I get into some tension with on my side, because my side tends to be so overly sex positive, to the point where, in my opinion, it isn't sex positive at all, because it has no respect for sexuality, actually. So you want to just talk about your critique of hookup culture?
Clems, thank you so much. That feels just, it was the hardest chapter to write. I'm sorry, Clementine. I always get that wrong. I had always felt this weird dissonance between the choices that I had made sexually as someone who's pretty bloody feminist and actually a fairly sexual person, and the way they had felt life-giving versus the kind of public story of what the kind of Christian sexual ethic was, as excluding and exclusive and a cosh to beat people with and positioning sex as dirty or guilt-inducing or any of those things. And so I was trying to make a case for the golden thread that I think is through the teaching of my faith, which is sex is powerful and we need to take power seriously. Right? If we, and this is, you know, this is my underlying anthropology, if we are made for each other and made by each other, if fully aliveness is connection, is deep, I thou, as you said, seeing and being fully seen, knowing and being fully known, then sex is both the like tenderest, most beautiful fulfillment of that and the easiest place to cause each other harm. And so a lot of the strictures around sex in my tradition, and I came to a lot of this through reading a guy called Luke Bretherton, who's a theological ethicist, I was like, why, given how badly they've been misused, does it still feel like there's something here for me? And it's because of this thing that is at the heart of the whole Christian ethic, I think, which is never treat another human being like an object. Human beings are sacred. You know, in my framework, they are made in the image of the divine. They are walking icons of a loving God, and a God who is itself relational, right? That's the weirdness of the Trinity, that there was love. There was love between persons before there was anything else, before there were humans. And we are relational, like fundamentally deepest prior about humans. And if we do anything, if we spend money, right, if we have politics that treat humans like objects, not as ends in themselves, infinitely vulnerable and beautiful and precious, that's sin for me. Like, that's disconnection. That's dehumanizing. And if we have sex in ways, and even frankly, I have some caution around a lot of porn use. If we use porn in ways that are treating human beings like objects, there is soul danger in it. And there is soul danger for ourselves, because it's not honest to treat a human like they're an object. And there is a huge amount of soul danger for the other person, because no one flourishes when they are treated like an object. And so that, like, take care with each other. Avoid, and this is my definition of lust, like extractive forms of sexuality that do not take seriously human vulnerability. And then the particularly feminist thing is, and this, you know, will maybe be controversial because I don't even know what gender is anymore, but I have a deep conviction that there is a, at least for straight women having sex with men, there is a power imbalance at play. Right. Yes. There is a bodily vulnerability. Sexual violence is a thing. And so actually requiring us to take that seriously in our sexual relationships, inviting us to treat each other with sufficient care to avoid causing harm, is is the argument I'm trying to make and what I see as missing in a lot of hookup culture, which rightly threw off the shackles of kind of guilt and negativity around sex, but I think in some places actually elides particularly female, but in general, human vulnerability in the process and therefore is causing quite a lot of background harm.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And I think that we are collectively on my side, like in the polyamorous, queer, like sex positive world, you know, we are kind of really in denial about this. And I think it's starting to come up. We're starting to start to have these conversations. But even me being controversial as I am, like I have felt the tension when I have tried to bring up these conversations because people are so afraid that if we, you know, criticize sex positivity in any way, then we will immediately land back in sex negativity and shame. And I'm like, it's not one or the other. We have to be able to find the middle ground. And the middle ground for me and like the important thing is exactly what you're saying. It's wrong to treat someone like an object. You have to see the person. You have to see the eyes looking back. You have to honor that responsibility and like the inherent risk of the vulnerability that people share in sexuality. And you have to be careful, you know? And I think that there's a lot of carelessness and the gender dynamic. Like I can see you and I can feel you being so careful in talking about that because you're worried because it's so fraught. And you know what? Like, yes, everybody around me is queer and trans and non-binary and lots of people are gender fluid and whatever. But at the same time, we cannot just throw feminism out and act as if gendered violence against women is not a thing. And that like the way that straight and bisexual women, because this is the hilarious thing about me is that I am a part-time straight girl, you know? And so I'm very invested in straight women's liberation. And I really do not like except just sort of glossing over all of that and being like, well, it's sex positive. I'm like, no, actually, like what I'm hearing from younger women, like even like Gen Z women, is that it is now just considered normal in hookups for men to be choking them and doing like really aggressive, rough sex without communication, without any negotiation or like any of the containers that in like BDSM would have been there to make sure that this is like done consensually and with care. It's just done totally randomly and without any kind of like care at all, you know? And this is not acceptable. Like this is sexual violence and actually really dangerous. But it's been so normalized that women don't even feel comfortable like naming it. And I think that for us, you know, as women who are a bit older and have a bit more life experience, we actually have a responsibility to talk about this. We have a responsibility.
So it's not okay.
Yeah. And to be role models for younger women and to be like, actually, you're allowed to say no to that. You're allowed to point out that that's disrespectful. And like, there is a connection between compulsive sexuality and trauma. This is not sex negative to say. I'm a sexual abuse survivor in my early 20s, and I was totally just having crazy sex with all sorts of guys who totally disrespected me. And that is a trauma reenactment, you know? And then when I decided to, like, my story is that when I decided to own my sexuality, it still was a non-monogamous sexuality. But I think that people think that that means, they assume that that means that I just hook up with people or I have sex all the time right away. And I'm like, no, I usually do not have sex on the first date. I take a long time to get to know people. I take a long time to build trust. I just do that in a non-monogamous way. But
it's really interesting because I was, you know, I was like, God, I'm a 40-year-old woman who's only had sex with one man. I'm going to sound like such a vanilla prude, like, there were two things that happened. One was talking to, and this came a little bit after, but talking to a guy called Luke Turner, who I had an amazing conversation with on the podcast that I would love to point listeners to, because he also abuse survivor, long period of compulsive sexual behavior. And he similarly really wrestled with saying it's not sex negative to acknowledge that this link between compulsive sexual behavior and trauma. And he was like, and when I was having sex with everyone, you know, all over London, in that scene, if you have an honest conversation with people, large numbers of them are processing something, right? And some people would say they're processing it healthily, and some people they're processing unhealthily. And that's sort of for them to decide. But he was like, I didn't even feel I could say that until I was like, I'm just owning my own story. Mm-hmm. And I talked to, when I was in the process of writing the book, I talked to, I was at a festival, and there was these two, they'll probably know who I'm talking about. So these two very, very cool young women in their early 20s, just like intimidatingly beautiful. And I was like, I feel like such an old lady. But I was sort of workshopping some of these ideas, because I was like, it feels like there's something here. How does it sound to you? I desperately don't want to be patronizing. But it feels like there's something in my politics as well as in my theology that means I have to say this. And one of them said, I'm, and I know this isn't true of anyone, but she's like, I'm poly, but I'm like, just trying, I've been doing it 5 years, and I'm trying to get to the point that I enjoy it. Because she was like, it's a principled decision. And I feel ashamed of the bit of me that wants to be monogamous. And I was like, okay, that's a bit complex. And the other woman said, I've never been with a man who didn't hurt me. I was like, okay. So saying, it's not kink shaming, right? To acknowledge that some of the ways our current sexual culture is set up is not working for everybody. And something within the Christian sexual ethic, for all the ways it's been misused, actually might have some, you know, air quotes, ancient wisdom for how we think about how we have sex.
Yeah, I actually thought you made a really interesting point as well. That because I never thought about this when I was thinking about lust in the Bible. Like, of course, I have read a little bit of the Bible, but actually I have read like the Old Testament more. But this whole thing about lust, like, I just assumed that it meant sexuality, you know? And you make the distinction that it is sexuality that is not seeing the other as a person that is exploitative or dominating in some way, that is not actually a relationship between equals in which the other person is seen. And so, like, lust is like sexuality expressed in a dehumanizing way. And and one of the things that you point out that I thought was really interesting and kind of an important point, so I just want to bring it up, is the stuff about like the homophobic bits of the Bible, you know, like the things in the Bible that are talking about same-sex relationships. And, you know, obviously lots of people are really upset about that. But you make the point that in that time and in that context, like they're talking about sex between men, and most of the sex that between men that would have been happening, given the historical context, would have been in this kind of power relationship where it is, you know, someone and his slave, or someone and like a younger boy who doesn't have a lot of power, right? And so that was sort of like linked in the minds of people at that time. And so it doesn't actually say anything about what we now have, which is like consensual, loving, respectful relationships between people of the same sex, you know? So I actually thought that's a great point to let Christian homophobes know. Like,
it's one of the places that I am trying to untie this very knotty thing. And I have, you know, as someone, I'm a crosser of tribes, I've dear people in my life have come to different conclusions on this, right?
Of course.
It's a really complex book.
But it's cool that there is, like, because I'm not asking you or anybody to be the official word, you know, but the fact that that interpretation can be there, I think it gives some breathing room, you know, and it allows for an interpretation that is not homophobic, which I think is, I personally appreciate that.
Good.
So, okay. There's so many good sins here. I'm trying to think which ones are the ones I really wanted to talk about, but
I love that I've made you say the phrase, there's so many good sins here.
Well, okay, let's talk about gluttony, because I think your framing of this is very interesting, because it's basically you're talking about addiction. You're talking about addiction with gluttony, and you also make the distinction, you know, you're like, Christians love their feast days. Like, it's not the feasting that's the problem. It's not enjoying food. It's not like the sensual pleasure of enjoying like a good food or good drink. That's not the issue. But the issue is this numbing, this like using food or using drink or just like using whatever. I don't know if gluttony only applies to eating. Okay, so it could be anything.
So we're just, in my definition, yes.
Your definition. Okay. So just what we're using to sort of like stuff ourselves full so that we don't have to feel our feelings. And so I do tons of work on addiction. Obviously, I am an addict. And I thought that was an interesting reframe of gluttony. And then I love where you take it, because your sort of response to that, your answer to that is excellent. Beautiful. I think that's so beautiful. So you want to talk about that? Like, why, what do you mean by ecstasy? And like, why is ecstasy the answer to gluttony?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, part of me is like, it's because something deep in my temperament resists this concept of sobriety, which maybe says there is more work for me to do on myself. But so my answer is kind of sobriety and, right? I often feel this weird like jealousy of the recovery community. And I'm someone who's not, you know, I have read a lot about it because I find there's so much wisdom there, but not an expert. So feel free to correct me. Mm-hmm. My kind of understanding as I dug into the tradition is that, and it's not just in the recovery community, like most wisdom paths will say we are longing for something more.
Yes.
Right. There is something within us that wants more. Nick Cave says this. It's like, I was addicted to heroin and now I'm interested in God. That there is a connection between our longings for substances of all kinds and our longings for transcendence. And there's a famous letter that Carl Jung sent around this that talks about spiritus contra spiritum.
I was going to bring it up because it's in the big book. Yeah.
So you guys probably, I was like, this is amazing. You know, this like actually that, and that's why, and I know it really drives a lot of people bonkers, but that's why the recovery movement has held so strongly onto this, like God, however you understand them, that we have a yearning for something, right? And it doesn't have to be, I know you've talked about Jay and his atheism. It doesn't have to be supernatural necessarily, but we long to self-transcend. Mm-hmm. You know, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the top of it is self-transcendence. We long to get out of our heads, to out of ourselves, into a bigger story, into a bigger sense. And for me, that's very much in these like ecstatic experiences of the love of God that I have in my kind of Pentecostal worship practice. I want, it's going to make me cry, like, I want to get on my knees and come face to face, really, with the love of God, with something bigger and better than myself. And it is in those experiences that I feel like my soul gets filled up sufficiently that I stop craving this kind of like the sugary treats that are not really, that don't really satisfy, but act as a substitute sometimes. And so whenever I'm, and I do like, I have been known to drink too much. I have had periods in my life of eating in sort of unhealthy, slightly disordered ways. And when I get aware of it, very often it's that actually I'm not putting my roots down deep into my spirituality. I'm not spending time in the self-transcendent settings of worship and awe and ecstasy. And I put this to Dacher Kältner, who's this like world-leaning psychologist of awe, as I'm like, this is my back of the envelope theory. And he was like, that's actually really interesting. And I'm going to go away and think about it and see what I can come up with the studies. But it was like, it's not mad that that the addictive behaviors can be linked to the loss of this, because I think we have had a loss of it in society.
Yes.
I would love there to be more space for it.
Absolutely. I mean, what I love, I completely relate and I completely understand, because it is exactly that. It's in AA, in 12-step communities, like it's very much like you need a spiritual connection of some kind. And that is the basis of recovery. And I really found that like I was a very spiritual child in my own way, like in my nature way. I had a very intense spirituality with the natural world that I lived in as a child. But then, you know, so much trauma, there's so much trauma. And then alcohol and drugs became the thing that just totally let me like the bottle became my God, you know, because the bottle was the thing that just like let me just completely numb out of all of it. And I did that for years until I found recovery. And then I started to reconnect with my spirituality. And that has been really life-giving. But I think sometimes, especially when you look at it in a, when people who aren't Christians and sort of have stereotypes about this, look at this from a Christian lens, I think people just think, they imagine it in this way that's very like, I don't know how to explain it, like boring, stuffy, like not exciting, definitely not something you would call ecstatic, like not something you would call pleasurable, something that feels restrictive. And even sobriety itself, you know, I think people think about sobriety that way. I've often said, people always define sobriety as the absence of something and not as something unto itself, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you don't take substances for 10 years or more, what becomes possible for you in that time is like, it's very generative and rich and full. It's something unto itself. It's not just the absence of drinking, right? Yeah. And so like, I really think, like, with spirituality, if we are imagining, you know, for like, oh, we're doing all these drugs or we're eating all this food and like, this is like, I know it's actually empty and numbing, but it's giving me something. And now you're telling me that I need to like restrict and like control myself. That feels not helpful. But in fact, these practices could actually be super pleasurable and super like viscerally enjoyable, you know? And I think that that's something that people need to know about spirituality in whatever form it takes. And also part of the reason why I love the word ecstatic here is that I've recently, in the last maybe 8 months or so, become a very regular ecstatic dancer. I go ecstatic dancing every week.
I love it. Do you do five rhythms?
No, but I actually have heard about five rhythms, and there is one in Montreal. I haven't checked it out yet. But ecstatic dance is more unstructured than that. It is just literally the only thing is to listen to your body and do what your body wants to do. And then the music, it takes you on like a journey where it starts off very, very slow, builds to like a very, very high tempo, and then goes back down to very slow. And then at the end, people tend to just like lie down. And it's like a couple hours long and you're just dancing the whole time. There's no photos, no phones, no talking. And everyone is just doing whatever they want, which is sometimes very weird. And one of the things that I loved about it is that one of the reasons I hated dancing is because I hate being objectified. Like, I hate the way that as a woman, people look at my body when I'm moving, you know? So like, It doesn't make me feel good. But here, it was the first place I've ever seen women dancing. Yeah, there's women dancing in a sexy way, but there's also women dancing like a worm. You know what I mean? Like, people are doing such weird things. And that is so liberating. But I relate to what you're saying, because afterwards, like, I lose myself. I do not know who I am. And then at the end, like, my mental health has been completely reset. My entire body has been completely reset. And I feel so much like love and warmth and compassion for everyone around me. So it's definitely like, it's an ecstatic experience, you know? And this one is like a totally like, it could be a totally secular thing, like for people. It doesn't need any religious or even like overtly spiritual content. So it's open in many different forms, you know? And I think that the journey is for people to find like, where is the ecstasy that brings them closer to others and closer to themselves and closer to the world rather than numbing. So that's beautiful. I really love that. Okay. So I guess I want to let you talk about God a little bit, because I feel like, you know, your book does such a great job of opening these lessons and showing that they are like, these lessons have roots in a Christian tradition. They also have roots in other traditions. Like, you would find similar lessons in other traditions if you went looking. But you're showing it to people in a way that is like, you don't need to be a Christian to take these lessons. And so there's this broadness to that, but then there's also the specificity of your own experience as a Christian, you know, which I also think is important. Like, I think that sometimes when we have a specific identity and we're being very open and like, we sometimes can lose our specificity, or like, I don't know if you really get that, but like, it's hard sometimes to be so open and tolerant and being like, yeah, I accept all of you guys for who you are. And also I take who I am very seriously. And like, I'm allowed to be that too, you know? So I just want to give you an opportunity to be a Christian for a second and talk about God.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It was really interesting writing and again, this is something we have in common. I think the way we tend to handle conflict or difference is pretend it's not there, because we have received this script that difference is threat. But I think if we can see that when it's handled well, difference is a gift, we can be both, as you say, like, hold on to the real particularity of ourselves. And in this case, like, the love of God in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, right? And not have that mean that I don't want to be in a hospitable, open, empathetic, curious conversation with other people. So I wanted to write the book in a way that was like, if you have reason to be nervous about this, and I understand if you do, that the heart of the thing for me, that particularity is at the end, right? And the whole book has got the word God in square brackets, because I just needed to acknowledge that this is a word that jumps off the page and not always in good ways, right? And is we just lob it around as if everyone knows what they mean. and it is like semiotically dense. And at least from kind of my tradition, I'm so aware that when you raise the possibility of God, that's what, like, the possibility that there might be unconditional love beyond us, right?
Mm-hmm.
That justice might actually exist is almost too flammable a thing to hope for.
Mm-hmm.
And so taking care and not just like setting off an emotional firestorm in people without their consent was what I was trying to do. I was like, at the end is the heart of the thing for me, and I would not be honest about my tradition if I skipped that, but you can build up to it and decide if you trust me or not, basically, by the time that we get there, and that I'm not using it as some sort of power play or some exercise in manipulation,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I've seen done. So I hope by the time I get to it, there's a sense of, trust with the reader. But it's a incredibly difficult thing to talk about. It's not especially amenable to language, right? That these deep, you know, and these ecstatic experiences, this sense of encounter with another, with love, I was sort of like, I'm just going to give up and I'm just going to put a bunch of poetry in here because it's not, all prose feels like somehow doing violence to the tender and luminous reality that I certainly feel that I experience. It is my attempt to say, this is what I mean by that word. This is why Jesus is the theologians call it the scandal of particularity in relation to Jesus. Like the idea that God could like put on flesh and live as we do and like have bodily functions and desires and frustrations and get grumpy and hungry and tired, right? The solidarity with the suffering of a human body in his life and then in his death, like the life of a slave, the life and death of someone marginalized and excluded, and then the death of someone, the lynching of God, right? Mm-hmm. That the cross of Christ represents. The strangeness of that concept in the ancient world. I wanted to at least say this symbol, this story has been used, particularly now, to oppress and exclude.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I don't think that's what it's about for me. It's about wide open arms of hospitality for those who suffer most, because God suffers with us.
It's interesting because being someone who has grown up in like a Western Christian influenced but secularized culture, you know, I have received some information about like Christianity, but like not a lot, like, and weirdly, not a lot about Jesus. Because when I was approaching this chapter, I was like, oh yeah, God, no problem. Like, I've dealt with the God question a million times, you know, because in AA, it's like, whatever, God, as you understand God, there's so much discussion about God. So I was not concerned or worried about the God thing. But I was surprised by Jesus in a way. Because I just don't actually know that much about Jesus. And yeah, it was actually cool and interesting to actually hear some stories about Jesus, and also to hear like what you just said about kind of like a very central part of what makes Christianity Christian. It's also part of the reason why, like, because AA is like Christian inflected or Christian influenced, but it isn't Christian itself. You could do it in a Christian way, but it's not explicitly Christian. And like one of the ways in which it's not Christian is that there isn't any talk of Jesus at all. People never talk about Jesus, like unless a person was bringing that in the way that somebody else might bring in like creator or whatever, like people can do that, but there's no talk of Jesus in the text. Like it's always God in this very broad way because it's not meant to be. So in that way, I just never really knew that much about Jesus. And so that was very interesting for me. And it seems like Jesus was a very cool guy.
I think so. Yeah. It's what keeps me Christian.
Yeah.
It's the, given how deeply disappointing the church can be and other Christians, including me, it's this very enigmatic figure that we see in this Gospels who's very surprising. He is not meek and mild. He is loving. He's very confusing. Yeah, just the figure of Jesus, even just narratively, completely compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't shake him off, whatever I do. I don't want to. I have tried. But That's he seems beautiful. Like a cool guy.
He seems like a cool guy. And I was like, I was saying this in the last episode, but I was like, wow, I really, or like maybe two episodes ago, but I was like, I really relate to Jesus, because this attitude of being like, actually the most fucked up person in the room is the person that I want to be friends with. Mm-hmm. I want to be extending grace and compassion to people who everyone else is turning their back on, yeah, is, you know, actually kind of my whole thing. And something that people are so mad about, you know, like it's something that is really not acceptable in society to be like, no, the ones who are pushed to the margins are actually the ones who we should be giving our attention to and who we should be most concerned with. Yeah. So I think that that is really beautiful. And also the stance of like basically like assertive nonviolence of the turning the other cheek of just like, I'm here with you. I'm not fighting back. I'm not running away.
Shutting down, yeah.
But I'm like, I'm here. Like that, that was also very moving for me. So thank you, Jesus, for that.
Amen.
Okay, so the last thing I wanted to talk about is, and I wonder if you have thoughts on this. It isn't something that's really in the book, but it's something that is a question that I think about and that came up for me in the book, is that like what you're talking about, and you're talking about it in a Christian way, but you can talk about it in other ways too, is like, how do we live in alignment with our highest selves? How do we act in a principled way and actually take actions from our principles when we are animals who have nervous systems that send us into, you know, fight, flight, panic all the time, and especially for those of us with trauma? Right? For those of us, which is more and more of us, you know, like lots of people have some kinds of trauma and some of us have a lot of trauma. And when we are triggered, we are absolutely, it's very difficult to act in a principled way. And so I sometimes think people feel very daunted by this, in the sense that they're like, okay, that all sounds good. Like I do understand the difference between right and wrong, but like, how do I do it? And like, your book is like, it's full of suggestions. But I don't know, like I think you're very humble and honest in your own struggles with like living up to that, you know, and the gap between where you want to be and where you are. And I think you posit that the struggle and the journey is the thing, you know, it's not to arrive at perfection, but what are your thoughts on that? Like just the gap between like what we are currently capable of and like our highest selves and what we want to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's what drove me to write the book. I had this sense of like this cultural moment, this sense of apocalyptic end of the world, wars, climate change, raising division. It's forming me and it's changing me into someone I don't want to be. Mm. I'm more anxious. I'm more contemptuous. I'm less patient with the people that I love. And the sense that this is the genius of religions, right? The way people have changed over the centuries is through these paths. And I would probably put the recovery movement in that box, because I think the magic source is it's collective. They are collective rituals and practices that continually turn our attention back to the things we want to be forming us, rather than this sort of passive formation of social media and the news and all the other things that are shaping us. Mm. And so it's why I moved into community. We have this, you know, sort of monastic inspired, it's very small, it's just two families, but we pray morning prayer and we pray evening prayer. And we have every Monday, we have an open table dinner where it's a practice of hospitality, and we have fun baked into our time together, and we have conflict resolution baked into our time together. And we have in very intentional ways designed our time collectively to try and be growing in this direction. And I think part of the challenge is we live in such high individualized ways that we kind of, St. Paul in the New Testament says, I know the things I want to do. I don't do the things I want to do. And I do the things I don't want to do. And we try and fix that by sheer willpower. And we think if we listen to enough, and you know, you and I have podcasts and books and we're not decrying them, but if I listen to enough podcasts and I read enough books and I like get myself mentally, if I get my thinking straight, I'll be able to act in alignment with my values. I'll be able to become the kind of person the world needs. And I certainly did not find that to be the case. I think I need God's help and whatever you call God. But I also felt like what I needed was, some people might call them spiritual technologies, collective rituals and practices over time, because we change not by doing something once or having a thought once, by practicing them over time. And that's why I just think, despite everything, that religions or kind of quasi-religious movements as containers for human change, it's hard to know where else to go.
Yeah, I think what I hear is there's kind of like two components. One is you have this metaphor of the trellis, which I was like, what's a trellis? And I had to look it up. But so in case anyone else doesn't know what a trellis is, it's like a sort of, like a vine would grow on it and it holds the vine up.
Guides the plant.
It guides the plant to grow. And it gives like some scaffolding. I think you say scaffoldings too, like scaffolding, something that structures the growth, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, in AA, they say like, you can't think yourself into right action. You have to act yourself into right thinking, right? And so this idea that we can have lots of great ideas, but like, how do we live them and how do we embody them? And part of that is through structures and practice and repetition and having containers. And especially when those containers have other people involved who are sharing the same goals, that want the same outcomes for themselves. And people are in a collective process of like trying to, you know, build these qualities and like these ways of relating. So there's that. There's some kind of structure, some kind of container. And then I also just think that it's like people need, like doing all this is hard. It's hard work. Okay. It's very difficult. And so it's very challenging. And so like, we need to be filled up. Like we need something that fills the cup. And so like, that's what you're talking about when you're saying like, I need God, because you're saying that you plug into this transcendent experience, you have this encounter, and that is what fills you up and allows you to then, when you're not in the ecstatic experience and you're just normal and you're getting triggered or like being stressed out on the bus, that in those moments, you know, you still are a bit fueled by that. Mm-hmm. You can return to it like in yourself, and you can rely on these structures that you put into place to sort of. So I think that's a lot. And I think a lot of people are trying to put up trellises by sort of like having different, like they're trying to do self-help stuff. They're trying to like have habits and practices that are going to help them be better, but they actually aren't filling their cup anywhere. Like, that might be the piece that is missing for a lot of people.
I think I've heard you talk about this, but we didn't talk about envy. But in the chapter on belovedness, I think one of the real particular things about my tradition, and this is, again, not how the public story of it goes, is that I want to be someone who is growing into a better person, not because I need to earn anything, but out of a place of belovedness. That actually, what's hard is when we're like, I need to demonstrate my purity. I need to demonstrate my righteousness. I need to be worthwhile. I need to be of value as a human. And the concept of grace in my tradition is that I am already enough. I am already loved. I am already beloved. And then I want to be becoming a better person because it feels good and it feels better for the world. And it feels like I'm becoming more fully myself and more fully human, the more I'm stripping off these disconnecting temptations and these tendencies, that actually connection, justice, love, these are who I'm meant to be and I can grow towards them. Not I am failing to be a full human and I must work my ass off to become one. So I think that's another element of help from the outside that gives you a steadiness, because then you sort of unclench a bit and it's much easier to do it out of more of a place of peace than a place of striving.
That's so beautiful. Thank you for saying that and making that explicit, because I think sometimes I take that so for granted because it's so fundamental to my worldview, you know, but it is so missing for so many people because, unfortunately, you know, that first experience of unconditional positive regard that we should all have experienced in childhood, we unfortunately, many of us did not, due to, you know, either parents who are caught up in cycles of generational trauma or just parents who are fucking stressed out under capitalism and do not have the time, capacity, or energy to fully be present to their children in the way that would be most beneficial to their children's development, right? And then we move into an alienating society that is just telling us that our worth is based on how much we make or how we look or whatever. And so people are very afraid that they are not inherently lovable. And that is heartbreaking to me, because it is the most fundamental truth to me, is that like there is literally nothing you have to do to earn it. There is nothing you have to do. There is only one you, and that is like a profound miracle that you exist. And like it is inherent and just irrevocable, like your belonging and your belovedness. I like that phrasing of it. And I think if people started with that, oh my God, everything would be so much better, you know? Because then people could do this work from a place of, yeah, like you're saying, wanting to put more love in the world and wanting to find out more about who they are and who they can be and what's possible for them, rather than, oh, I'm trying to earn it and prove myself. Like, that's such a, it's not a good motivation. And it's always, it's shame-based. Like, it's always going to be coming back to this, like, feeling of deficit. Yeah. So thank you for that. Is there anything else about the book that you really wanted to talk about or say that I didn't get to in the questions?
I don't think so. They were great questions. And it's just a joy. It's been a real joy to, see this is the joy of listening to people not like yourself, right? It's much more interesting to go, oh, wait, we're different in these ways. And my goodness, are we following the same thread in other ways?
Totally. Like, I feel very, very aligned with your ethical framework. And I mean, you know, I am Irish diaspora, you know, so the Catholicism,
it's your ancestral heritage.
Yeah, Catholicism is not far back. It is definitely there. So I'm probably influenced by it, even in ways that I'm not aware of, both in good and bad ways. But I didn't find it difficult at all to enter into that book, even as someone who on paper looks really different. So I really encourage readers to check it out. I will put the links in the bio, in the bio. Oh my God, I'm on Instagram too much. I'll put the links in the show notes. And it's called Fully Alive and you guys should check it out. And is there anything else that you wanted to tell listeners about, like where to find you online or how to get hooked up with your work?
Yeah, the podcast is called The Sacred, and you should start with Clementine's episode, but then try and find someone that challenges you. That's my little practice and my invitation to listeners. Listen to someone who is outside your filter bubble, who you actually might find quite tricky. Mm. And that is a little spiritual practice that we can undertake. And then I have a Substack that's called morefullyalive.substack.com.
Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a huge pleasure for me too.